So if you take a look at the website of the New Zealand Sepsis Trust, which is sepsis.org.nz, you'll read some sobering statistics. 30 million people die globally from sepsis each year, 4.2 million of which are children, and a sepsis-related hospitalisation costs $56,000 here in New Zealand. But the one that should stick out to those of us working in urgent care is that 80% of sepsis cases originate in the community. So I'd like to welcome to our podcast Dr. Paul Huggan. Originally from Scotland, Paul is an acute medicine and infectious disease specialist at Waikato Hospital and is a trustee of the New Zealand Sepsis Trust. So welcome to our podcast, Paul.
Hi, Guy. Happy to be here.
So I think the best place to start with this is, what is sepsis? How would you define it, and what is it?
Okay, so sepsis has a formal definition, and currently the definition we're using is what's called the sepsis 3 definition, which is that sepsis is a life-threatening condition caused by a dysregulated immune response to infection. And part of the problem we face is, of course, if you try and share that with somebody at a dinner party, they'll not invite you back. So to give people a much more simple bead on what sepsis is, quite frankly, it's blood poisoning. It's a condition caused by infection where your immune response to that infection causes organ failure.
And it seems from these statistics that we're probably missing too many cases of sepsis, or maybe not picking them up early enough. So why is sepsis so hard to identify early?
Yeah. Well, I think your listeners will probably appreciate why, based on the volumes of infections that we actually see. I think that we've done a bad job of raising the profile of infectious diseases in New Zealand specifically. Infectious disease admissions here have been rising for at least the last 3 or 4 decades, and the problems that we have with inequity, and particularly effects of inequity on Māori and people with chronic morbidities, plus the effects of some medical therapy like immunosuppressive therapy for cancers and rheumatologic disease. I just think that the volume of presentation with infection is climbing. And you know yourself, if you've seen, 10 pneumonias in the last couple of weeks, 9 of those patients will probably be able to go home with pneumonia. But for reasons that we don't always understand, that 10th person will still have pneumonia, but will have sepsis. So sepsis is not the same as an infection. It's caused by an infection, but if you don't, you have to have that dysregulated immune response to it to cause the organ failure, to cause the bad outcomes that we see with sepsis. And we certainly do see bad outcomes. So a hospitalized patient with sepsis will have no less than 5% inpatient mortality, and it rises to above 30% if you're admitted with sepsis to an intensive care unit here in New Zealand.
So early recognition is important.
Yeah, so the difficulty is you've got a large population at risk, and the difficulty in contrast to myocardial infarction and stroke, where the symptoms are maximal at onset, is that sepsis has a lead-in. So people typically feel very sick, sicker than they ever have before. Perhaps they've rigored. There may be a very concerned carer. There's very distressing accounts of sick children with sepsis whose mothers and fathers have felt that something's badly wrong. And so it's certainly a disease that can be missed, and probably because in a small proportion of people it builds up to a crescendo over time. So the trick, and I think particularly in urgent care, is to know what to look for early on in the course of the illness, and perhaps when sepsis can actually be prevented.
So the Sepsis New Zealand Trust is raising the awareness. That's part of obviously what you're intending to do.
Yeah, that's right.
And if you go to the Sepsis website, you can find some trial forms to download, which are pre-hospital screening tools for sepsis. And if we start looking at that, maybe we can go through there's 3 boxes. It's very straightforward. The first box includes 4 points that you have to look for in the presence of presumed infection. Patient looks very unwell, family or carer concerned, there is an ongoing deterioration, and the physiology is abnormal for this patient. So one of those 4 is enough to have you thinking sepsis.
Yeah.
And is this designed just to be the prompt for us in the community?
Yeah, that's right. So we're very much following the lead of the UK Sepsis Trust, which have, for the last several years, been marketing sepsis under the byline of just ask, could it be sepsis? So that first box is about catching people's attention and saying, I've seen 10 pneumonias in the last week, but this person just looks sicker than the other 9. if we're going to keep on going with that example, something's wrong here, they're not getting better, they look ill, someone's worried. So that box is really about prompting a sort of a second check, if you like. Yeah.
So that first one, patient looks unwell, that's your professional opinion. The second one, family or carer is very concerned. Is that quite a significant indicator?
Yeah, it is, particularly amongst children and in the elderly. So one of the key features of sepsis is that there's a component of delirium and apathy that goes with it. And some people are less able to explain why they're feeling ill. And if they're wrapped up in bed, you're not really sure of what they previously behaved like or looked like or how they typically function. It's usually their next of kin who know that something's very different, and that's a prompt to just to think a little harder about what is actually going on. Yeah,
well, it's important to listen to the family concerns and not dismiss them. The ongoing deterioration we see in respect of patients returning, or they've seen their GP earlier in the week, and we've got to pick up on that kind of pattern of repeat presentation. And then the physiological abnormalities for the patient are covered in the second box. So if you've had one of those, you proceed to the next box. And then the second box includes some parameters which are listed as red flag parameters. So you only need one of these to then diagnose sepsis.
I think there's a few things going on here. So certainly the red flags, what they indicate are that they're seriously abnormal physiology is present. So the red flags are there because they either indicate that somebody's very at risk of sepsis, like recently had chemotherapy, the implication there being that they have no neutrophils, or that their physiologic parameters are abnormal enough to increase their chance of death if they're hospitalized. So the red flags are really taken from the studies of abnormal physiology in hospitalized populations. So for example, if your respiratory rate is above 25 breaths per minute in hospital, then your chance of having a bad outcome in terms of death or ICU admission is substantially greater than the general hospitalized population. So what the red flags are telling you is that this person has a risk of a bad or a poor outcome. It's not quite the same as saying that the person has sepsis, because at this point you're screening a population at risk. So this would indicate that this person is at high risk of a final diagnosis of sepsis and is worthy of escalation of treatment and care with a view to confirming the diagnosis.
Okay, so that list is a decrease in GCS or AVPU, a systolic of less than 90, heart rate of over 130, the respirates are 25, oxygen required to keep saturations above 92, the non-blanching rash, urine output, not passing urine in 18 hours, or 0.5 mils per kilogram per hour, or chemo within the last 6 weeks. So any one of those boxes has us proceed to the next box, which is arrange immediate transfer to hospital. And in those settings, we are referring to the appropriate specialty who would manage that, whatever the source of that sepsis is. And you're recommending that it's an ambulance transfer in this sort of setting. Is that it's listed on the box here? Alert the ambulance crew to red flag sepsis.
That's right. Yeah. Well, I mean, the challenge that's raised by designing these tools for New Zealand is that there is an urgent care layer to the acute assessment system, if you call it that, between pure general practice or somebody pitching up in a general practice with no facilities for resuscitation, and then turning up at a secondary or tertiary hospital. I guess that the response may be somewhat different in an urgent care, where you may have access to a wider range of antibiotics and some resuscitation equipment. Your listeners can look at the Sepsis 6, which is the bundle of six actions which we recommend to address the issue of whether of resuscitating somebody with sepsis, and consider what elements of that they would be able to complete where they work. But certainly the benefit of having language around sepsis or the risk of sepsis red flags is that you can share your concern and you can share the critical language with somebody on the other end of the telephone. So in the situation of infection with red flags, that person as a minimum needs to be observed. And where I work, most of observation and for people who are at risk of deterioration would be done in a hospital. But to accept that there are certainly variations in the way that people may respond depending on where they are and what facilities they have available where they're working, yeah.
So the Sepsis 6 is available through your website as well, alongside an inpatient sepsis pathway. And the six things that you're referring to in the Sepsis 6 is administering oxygen, taking blood cultures, giving IV antibiotics, IV fluids, serial lactates, and measuring urine output. So some of these are certainly available in most urgent care clinics, IV fluids, oxygen, antibiotics, blood cultures. I guess it's down to each individual person how long or they observe somebody in a community setting versus referring, but the I'm getting the sense that this is a guide to prompt us to think, and it's not necessarily a rigid, determined.
Absolutely, kind of, And in the education, we've been involved in rolling out a hospital or system-wide sepsis quality improvement project at Waikato District Health Board, and our local education is really all about empowerment. We want to empower nurses to use the term sepsis, say that they're worried about sepsis, maybe take the first couple of steps in resuscitating somebody who's very sick. It's certainly not wrong to give somebody oxygen who needs oxygen. It's certainly right to take blood cultures before you give antibiotics if you're worried about a serious infection. And I invite people to look at the tools and realise that there is a lot of flexibility within that. So, for example, in fluids, we're only advising a fluid bolus if there's evidence of hypotension or what you might think of as hypoperfusion, so a high lactate or somebody looking very drowsy, very cold, very unwell. A 500ml bolus of fluid would not be inappropriate in most situations. But of the six steps that are listed, the key step is giving antibiotics. That's the absolute key step at any stage in the chain of care.
And that's governed by the underlying cause, presumably.
Correct.
Which agent.
Absolutely.
Or is it a one-hit wonder in that regard? So just going back to the pre-hospital tool again, if you've got none of those red flags, there are then some amber flags. And what's the idea of the amber flag as a step down?
Yeah, so it's difficult to perhaps paint a picture on a podcast. But again, what we're talking about here is there's, you know, amongst everyone that you suspect, in whom you suspect infection, who is more at risk of having or developing sepsis? The red flags are the indicators that something really seriously amiss and you should proceed to the resuscitation steps that we just discussed. But of course there are people who may be at risk for one of a number of other reasons or don't quite have the abnormal physiology that goes along with the red flags. So the amber flags are simply, for the most part, they're abnormal findings which are probably abnormal for the patient but just fall short of a red flag. So, for example, a pulse above between 91 and 100, a respiratory rate between 20 and 25, or somebody who looks dyspneic, or someone who's hypothermic. These are just things which you should worry about as they accumulate. So, for example, if an elderly patient is hypothermic and has a pulse rate of 100 but is on a beta blocker, that would be two amber flags together, and then you may think a little bit harder about whether you're going to send that person home or whether you're going to observe them. And actually, I think you might be about to point to the box below the amber flags, which suggests that, you know, as you accumulate amber flags, which are risk factors for a final diagnosis of sepsis, you really should start to think very carefully about what your next steps are going to be, even if that falls short of actually treating for an infection or referring to hospital.
So yeah, the next step, if you've got those amber flags in the absence of the red flags, is you're recommending second assessments. So that would, in our line of work, ensure either a follow-up with the GP or with ourselves, safety netting with the patient and the family. Again, that's important because when patients are discharged, the family might think that, oh, they've been seen and treated, nothing's good. They have to be forewarned to notice any deterioration, because that then re-enters you at the front of the pathway again as that person who's getting ongoing deterioration. And that, again, is a flexible thing depending on where the patient lives, how old they are, what their family's like. There's a number of factors involved in that. So the whole pathway is designed to make us think about sepsis each time and to consider it in the presence of the huge variability of that we face every day. And if we were to be thinking sepsis more and picking up more cases, that will probably mean we're referring more to hospital. From the community setting, the admitting registrars, is this a language that they're being trained to kind of listen to from our perspective?
Oh, increasingly over time, our hope is that this language gets built into programs of care in hospitals and in healthcare curricula. And so over time, the answer would hopefully be yes. Simply saying red flag sepsis or I'm very concerned about sepsis and I'd like you to see this person would be a prompt to listen carefully and to help your colleague out if you're on the receiving end. And everything else that you said is correct. Yeah, this is about trying to facilitate action where it may be needed. I'm not sure about referring more people to hospital, actually. Our studies of sepsis at Waikato Hospital indicate that most people are arriving by ambulance from their own homes. And there is a sort of a... It's not completely clear how quickly people with sepsis become ill, but we found that the sickest people with sepsis are actually falling sick and presenting to hospital by ambulance about 80% of the time. So yes, they're presenting in the community, but a large number are bypassing primary and urgent care simply because they feel so unwell.
Do we know how many of those were maybe seen prior to calling that ambulance? So maybe 24, 48 hours earlier.
Yeah.
How many of them were being safety netted or properly managed prior to that?
So I can talk to that using our local data relating to respiratory presentations. So it's relatively common for people who are admitted with pneumonia to have sought advice 1 or 2 days earlier on. And I think that's to do with viral chest infections. I think a number of people who present ultimately with bacterial pneumonia do have viral prodromes before they get a bacterial pneumonia superimposed on that infection. And but in other groups, most people are coming to hospital and to urgent care looking ill, perforated appendices, cellulitis of their limb, septic arthritis, that kind of thing. And pretty much coming through the hospital system. So for that reason, I don't think we're going to see a lot more antibiotic prescribing because of this. I think it's the actions around recognition and referral which we can improve on.
Okay. So that sounds like our safety netting is the important part then of this pathway that we've thought about sepsis, and we've made sure the patient and their family know that if they deteriorate, they get maybe seen sooner, maybe not via us again, but straight to the hospital, as the statistics would suggest. You mentioned antibiotic resistance there and the like. That you also mentioned the blood cultures. If we're considering antibiotics in someone who's sick, you want blood cultures taken early. But that's not the case if we're not considering they're septic, but they have an infection, like a urine infection, that's suitable for...
Yes,
for that.
Absolutely.
We're following normal guidelines in those ways. There's a feeling that, or is it true that blood cultures are affected by prior antibiotic treatment significantly?
Yeah, they are. There's good information on that now. It's time dependent. So within an hour of giving an antibiotic, blood culture is probably still going to be positive. From about 1 to 2 hours onwards, the rate of positivity of blood cultures after administration of broad-spectrum antibiotics drops significantly, particularly for gram-negative organisms like E. coli. Just to give your listeners an indication of how useful blood cultures are in a red flag sepsis group, this is not published yet, but in our audit of about 250 cases of red flag sepsis, 40 About 46% of people had a positive blood culture that was significant. So one in two people being admitted with red flag sepsis to our hospital have got positive blood cultures. So there's all sorts of advice out there about blood culturing, when you should do it and when you shouldn't do it. I agree with you that if you think you're just treating a urinary tract infection without sepsis, then don't do a blood culture. But blood cultures appear to be particularly useful when people are clearly very unwell with infection. We're getting high positivity rates, and that's very, very useful as an infectious disease physician a couple of days later when we're trying to build an antibiotic regime, typically to help people home.
So that person who's sick that we are ambulancing to hospital, we're sticking a line and giving fluids, get the blood cultures off pre-antibiotics makes a big difference once they get to you.
Yeah.
The other question I would have about bloods are in the amber flag sort of person you're sending home, do things like white blood counts and CRPs give us any reassurance, or is it a bit of a false reassurance for somebody's got a CRP of 10, therefore they're not going to be somebody you're particularly worried about?
I think that's on a sliding scale, isn't it? I mean, the more severe the abnormality, the less reassured you are, the lower the numbers, particularly regarding the CRP, then maybe the more reassured you feel. But I think most of this should go on what you're seeing rather than what the numbers you're getting back. If you're worried about somebody, then plan accordingly.
So not to rely on the bloods, but as all of this is seeming to show that it's an overall picture that you have to apply clinical experience and family concerns and the physiology and a whole load of other things, and then consider it. And if we do that, we should be improving those numbers, those statistics, in terms of deaths worldwide.
That's what we're aiming for, yeah.
So the sepsis.org.nz is where everyone should head to find these pre-hospital and in-hospital algorithms. And there's also some stories on there that are about people who've been through sepsis, which are worth reading to it sort of highlights of how these cases can go and how they can go south quite quickly.
Yeah. I think that it's relatively unusual to follow somebody who's had sepsis across their whole journey. The feedback we've had from people who work in the emergency department is that they find it very useful to know what the final outcome has been of people they've admitted, for example, to ICU or to the wards, because they very rarely get to meet that patient again. But the website tells stories from end to end from the patient's perspective. And I think it's very useful to point out that patients' experience of working their way through the hospital system is often quite frightening. They often feel quite unsafe, particularly if they feel that sepsis or the severity of their infection has been missed or underplayed. And certainly in the case of some of the people we work with, the ultimate outcomes are really quite poor, particularly for those people who have been admitted to intensive care. The long-term consequences of sepsis are increasingly recognised as being more like a chronic condition than an acute and recoverable condition. So particularly people who've been in intensive care will often have problems with post-traumatic stress disorder, quite easily fatigability, quite a lot of muscle weakness, some of post-ICU complications like critical illness, neuropathy and so on. And so they can be quite badly affected, and that's probably worse the more organ failure that has accumulated in the beginning. So the push to try and get identification and treatment going early is to try and to slow down or even prevent the accumulation of organ failure, which can affect people's longer term outcomes. So they might still have their infection identified and treated, but what you're trying to do is make sure that poisoning doesn't accumulate with organ failure and the negative outcomes that can be associated with that.
So I guess your message to our community would be that our role in this, when somebody is that sick that they're, like you say, calling an ambulance and going to ICU, that's at one end of the spectrum. And at the other end of the spectrum, there's the hundreds and thousands of people we see and send home who never go anywhere near sepsis. But that there's that little portion of the community that we're going to come in contact with who we could pick up earlier, either when we're with them or at least safety net them appropriately such that when they do deteriorate, they're getting help at a suitable time and not delaying things so that the treatment is commenced sooner.
And from that point of view, on the website under What is Sepsis, there's our brochure which you can print out and folds into a tri-leaflet brochure you can give to patients to give them more information about what sepsis might look like. So if people haven't yet developed the typical symptoms, you're a bit worried, you want them to have some information, that's there to print out and provide. And it goes into a lot more detail about how people at home might respond if they feel things aren't going well.
So people should, like we say, go to that website, sepsis.org.nz, print off these algorithms so that they've got something to reference and prompt them to think, and to print off a load of those take-home leaflets which they can give to patients in that category that you're concerned but not concerned enough to refer, in the hope that we get them back sooner rather than later.
Yeah, and I think just because people may be interested in that, we've found that the tools are very useful to try and determine who may not need antibiotics, actually. Because I do acute medicine as well, we see a lot of people who are thought to have infection or might have infection, amongst other symptoms. And we have found ourselves withholding antibiotics for a small proportion of people who have got no amber or red flags, simply because they don't appear to be at any physiologic risk of deterioration. And in that group, we found the tools to be quite useful on the side of, I won't say restriction, because we want to give antibiotics in the right quantities to the people who need them, but certainly to try and help with good decision making. We found that the absence of red and amber flags makes a decision to narrow the spectrum of an antibiotic or even not to give it to be much easier.
That's an interesting point, because obviously that's another part of your role, both as an infectious disease specialist, is the antibiotic stewardship and trying to avoid that, which is a whole other topic. But you're saying that this is actually helping people kind of decide to fall on a watch and see kind of side of things rather than jumping to the script.
Yeah, that's something we feel fairly strongly about in the trust, is that we're probably making a mistake if we regard antimicrobial stewardship as purely being antimicrobial restriction. Stewardship would simply be giving the right drug to the right person at the right time. And if you're restricting your total antibiotic use, it's to preserve antimicrobials for when people have sepsis, which is absolutely the condition in which you would want to be giving somebody an antibiotic. So where I work locally, we're trying to make sure that these conversations are actually integrated, so people understand that identifying and treating sepsis carefully and correctly is part of an overall antimicrobial stewardship effort.
So there's a Pandora's box we could open there on going down this road, but essentially on the sepsis front, we want people to think about sepsis, and the more they think about it, the less we're going to miss it. And if they follow these sorts of guidelines, and if they involve families, and if they involve patients in safety netting, and also involving the GPs, paramedics, the whole community out there responsible for looking after these people, we're not going to miss those people, or we're going to pick them up earlier, get them the treatment earlier, and then maybe mean they don't have the long going problems if they survive, obviously, that you've mentioned.
That's right.
So thinking about sepsis is what it's all about.
Indeed.
Great. So I hope you're all listening, and I'd like to thank Paul Huggan for talking to us today. Thank you very much.
Thanks for inviting me to take part.
My thanks again to Paul for talking with our podcast. In the show notes are links to the Sepsis Trust website and their clinical tools and patient information leaflets, which you can download and use. There is also a link to the BPAC page on sepsis. Hopefully, by thinking of sepsis and by being guided by the tools, we can identify and treat septic patients earlier, and also safety net our consultations such that patients are seen earlier in case of deterioration. I would also encourage you to take the time to read some of the patient stories on the sepsis website. These provide a patient's perspective to their journey and highlight how it feels to be septic and the experience of recovering from sepsis. Finally, the Sepsis Trust in New Zealand is looking to employ 5 part-time nurse educators for each of the major centres in the country. They're looking to undertake research into sepsis awareness, and they're looking to develop quality improvement programmes. In order to achieve this, they rely on donations and bequests. They have a donate button on their website, so if you can share this with your friends, post a link on your social media, or discuss it at your peer group, you can contribute to furthering the fight against sepsis here in New Zealand. Now, we'll be back again next week with another podcast. I look forward to seeing you all then, but for now, thanks for listening.